remembered what the ER doctor had said about Gonzalez and how the most serious damage was internal. Was his own immune system shutting down? Was he circling the drain? He suddenly thought of his daughter, getting a vision of her at the airport the last time he saw her. He cursed out loud. Harry? Bosch looked around the trunk lid. Rachel was walking toward him. The teams are headed this way. They'll be here in 5 minutes. How do you feel? I think I'm okay. Good. I talked to the head of the team. He thinks the exposure was too short to be anything serious, but you still should go to the ER and get checked out. We'll see. He reached into the trunk and got a liter bottle of water out of his kit. It was an emergency bottle he kept for surveillances that dragged on longer than expected. He opened it and took two strong pulls. The water wasn't cold, but it felt good going down. His throat was dry. Bosch recapped the bottle and put it back in the kit. He stepped around the car to Walling. As he walked toward her, he looked past her to the south. He realized that the alley they were in extended several blocks past the back of the Easy Print and ran behind all the storefronts and offices on Cahuenga, all the way down to Barham. In the alley, every 20 yards or so was a green dumpster, positioned perpendicular to the rear of the structures. Bosch realized they had been pushed out of spaces between the buildings and fenced corrals. Just like in Silver Lake, it was pickup day, and the dumpsters were waiting for the city trucks to come. Suddenly it all came to him, like fusion. Two elements coming together and creating something new. The thing that bothered him about the crime scene photos, the yoga poster, everything. The gamma rays had shot right through him, but they had left him enlightened. He knew. He understood. He's a scavenger. Who is? Digoberto Gonzalez, Bosch said, his eyes looking down the alley. It's collection day. The dumpsters are all pushed out for the city trucks. Gonzalez is a scavenger, a dumpster diver, and he knew they would be out and this would be a good time to come here. He looked at Walling before completing the thought. And so did somebody else, he said. You mean he found the cesium in a dumpster? Bosch nodded and pointed down the alley. All the way at the end, that's Barham. Barham takes you up to Lake Hollywood. Lake Hollywood takes you to the Overlook. This case never leaves the map page. Walling came over and stood in front of him, blocking his view. Bosch could now hear sirens in the distance. What are you saying? That Nasser and Al-Fayed took the cesium and stashed it in a dumpster at the bottom of the hill? Then this scavenger comes along and finds it? I'm saying you've got the cesium back, so now we're looking at this as a homicide again. You come down from the Overlook and you can be in this alley in 5 minutes. So what? They stole the cesium and killed Kent just so they could come down here and stash it? Is that what you're saying? Or are you saying they just threw it all away? Why would they do that? I mean, does that make any sense at all? I mean, I don't see that scaring people in the way we know they want to scare us. Bosch noted that she had asked 6 questions at once this time, possibly a new record. Nasser and Al-Fayed were never near the cesium, he said. That's what I'm saying. He walked over to the truck and picked the rolled poster up off the ground. He handed it to Rachel. The sirens were getting louder. She unrolled the poster in her hands and looked at it. What is this? What does it mean? Bosch took it back from her and started rolling it up. Gonzalez found that in the same dumpster where he found the gun and the camera and the lead pig. So? What does it mean, Harry? 2 Fed cars pulled into the alley a block away and started making their way toward them, weaving around the dumpsters pushed out for pickup. As they got close, Bosch could see that the driver of the lead car was Jack Brenner. Do you hear me, Harry? What does it? Bosch's knee suddenly seemed to give out, and he fell into her, throwing his arms around her to stop himself from hitting the ground. Bosch! She grabbed on and held him.
I'm not feeling so good, he mumbled.
I think I better... Can you take me to my car? She helped him straighten up and then started walking him toward his car. He put his arm over her shoulders. Car doors were slamming behind them as the agents got out. Where are the keys? Walling asked. He held the key ring out to her just as Brenner ran up to them. What is it? What's wrong? He was exposed. The cesium is in the center console in the truck cab. Be careful. I'm going to take him to the hospital. Brenner stepped back as if whatever Bosch had were contagious. Okay, he said. Call me when you can. Bosch and Walling kept moving toward the car. Come on, Bosch, Walling said. Stay with me. Hang in there and we'll get you taken care of. She had called him by his last name again. Chapter 18. The car jerked forward as Walling pulled out of the alley and into southbound traffic on Cahuenga. I'm taking you back to Queen of Angels so Dr. Gardner can take a look at you, she said. Just hang in there for me, Bosch. He knew it was likely that the last name endearments were about to come to an end. He pointed toward the left turn lane that led onto Barham Boulevard. Never mind the hospital, he said. Take me back to the Kent House. What? I'll get checked out later. Go to the Kent House. Here's the turn. Go! She slipped into the left turn lane. What's going on? I'm fine. I'm okay. What are you telling me? That little fainting spell back there was... I had to get you away from the crime scene and away from Brenner so I could check this out and talk to you. Alone. Check what out? Talk about what? Do you realize what you just did? I thought I was saving your life. Now Brenner or one of those other guys will take the credit for the recovery of the cesium. Thanks a lot, asshole. That was my crime scene. He opened his jacket and pulled out the rolled-up and folded yoga poster. Don't worry about it, he said. You can get the credit for the arrests. You just might not want it. He opened the poster, letting the top half flop over his knees. He was only interested in the bottom half. Danurasana, he said. Walling glanced over at him and then down at the poster. Would you start telling me what's going on? Alicia Kent practices yoga. I saw the mats in the workout room at the house. I saw them too, so what? Did you see the sun discoloration on the wall where a picture or a calendar or maybe a poster had been taken down? Yes, I saw it. Bosch held up the poster. I'm betting that we go in there and this will be a perfect fit. This is a poster Gonzalves found with the cesium. And what will that mean? If it's a perfect fit, it will mean that it was almost a perfect crime. Alicia Kent conspired to kill her husband. And if it hadn't been for Digoberto Gonzalves just happening to find the tossed-out evidence, she would have gotten away with it. Walling shook her head dismissively. Come on, Harry. Are you saying she conspired with international terrorists to kill her husband in exchange for the cesium? I can't believe I'm even doing this. I need to get back to the crime scene. She started checking her mirrors, getting ready to make a U-turn. They were going up Lake Hollywood Drive now and would be at the house in 2 minutes. No, keep going. We're almost there. Alicia Kent conspired with someone, but it wasn't a terrorist. The cesium being dumped in the trash proves that. You said it yourself. There is no way that Moby and Al-Fayed would steal this stuff to just dump it. So what does that tell you? This wasn't a heist. It actually was a murder. The cesium was just a red herring, just like Ramin Samir. And Moby and Al-Fayed, they were part of the misdirection as well. This poster will help prove it. How? Danurasana. The rocking bow. He held the poster up and over so she could glance at the yoga pose depicted in the bottom corner. It showed a woman with her arms behind her back, holding her ankles, and creating a bow with the front of her body. She looked like she was hogtied. Walling glanced back at the curving road and then took another long look at the poster and the pose. We go into the house and see if this fits that space on the wall, Bosch said. If it fits, that means she and the killer took it off the wall because they didn't want to risk that we might see it and connect it with what happened to her. It's a stretch, Harry, a huge one. Not when you put it in context. Which you, of course, can do. As soon as we get to the house. Hope you still have a key. You bet I do. Walling turned onto Arrowhead Drive and punched the accelerator. But after a block, she took her foot off, slowed down, and shook her head again. This is ridiculous. She gave us the name Moby. There is no way she could have known he was in this country. And then up on the overlook, your own witness said that the shooter called out to Allah as he pulled the trigger. How can... Let's just try the poster on the wall. If it fits, I'll lay the whole thing out for you, I promise. If it doesn't fit, then I will quit bothering you with it. She relented and drove the remaining block to the Kent house without another word. There was no longer a bureau car sitting out front. Bosch guessed that it was all hands on deck at the cesium recovery scene. Thank God I don't have to deal with Maxwell again, he said. Walling didn't even smile. Bosch got out with the poster and his file containing the crime scene photos. He used Stanley Kent's keys to open the front door, and they proceeded to the workout room. They took positions on either side of the rectangular sun discoloration mark, and Bosch unrolled the poster. They each took a side and held the top corner of the poster to the top corner of the mark. Bosch put his other hand on the center of the poster and flattened it against the wall. The poster was a perfect fit over the mark on the wall. What was more was that the tape marks on the wall matched up with tape marks and old tape on the poster. To Bosch, there was no doubt. The poster found by Digoberto Gonzalez in a dumpster off Cahuenga had definitely come from Alicia Kent's home yoga studio. Rachel let go of her side of the poster and headed out of the room. I'll be in the living room. I can't wait to hear you put this together. Bosch rolled the poster up and followed. Walling took a seat in the same chair Bosch had put Maxwell in a few hours earlier. He remained standing in front of her. The fear was that the poster could be a tip-off, he said. Some smart agent or detective would see the rocking bow pose and start thinking, this woman does yoga. Maybe she could handle being hog-tied like that. Maybe it was her idea. Maybe she did it to help sell the misdirection. So they couldn't take the chance. The poster had to go. It went into the dumpster with the cesium, the gun, and everything else they used, except for the ski masks and the phony map they planted with the car at Ramin Samir's house. She's a master criminal, Walling said sarcastically. Bosch was undeterred. He knew he'd convince her. If you get your people out there to check that line of dumpsters, you'll find the rest. The Coke bottle silencer, the gloves, the first set of snap ties, everything. The first set of snap ties? That's right. I'll get to that. Walling remained unimpressed. You better get a lot of it because there are big gaps in this thing, man. What about the name Moby? What about the sighting of Allah by the shooter? What about... Bosch held up a hand. Just hold on, he said. I need some water. My throat is raw from all of this talking. He went into the kitchen, remembering that he saw bottles of chilled water in the refrigerator while searching the kitchen earlier in the day. You want anything? He called out. No, she called back. It's not our house, remember? He opened the refrigerator, took out a bottle of water, and drank half of it while standing in front of the open door. The cool air felt good, too. He closed the door, but then immediately reopened it. He had seen something. On the top shelf was a plastic bottle of grape juice. He took it out and looked at it, remembering that when he went through the trash bag in the garage, he had found paper towels with grape juice on them. Another piece of the puzzle fell into place. He put the bottle back in the refrigerator and then returned out to the living room. where Rachel was waiting for the story. Once again, he remained standing. Okay, when was it that you captured the terrorist known as Moby on video at the port? What does please? Just answer the question. August 12th, last year. Okay, August 12th. Then what, some sort of alert went out through the Bureau and all of Homeland Security? She nodded. Not for a while, though, she said. It took almost 2 months of video analysis to confirm it was Nasser and Al-Fayed. I wrote the bulletin. It went out October 9th as a confirmed domestic sighting. Out of curiosity, why didn't you go public with it? Because we have... Actually, I can't tell you. You just did. You must have someone or some place where you think these two might show up under surveillance. If you go public, they might just go underground and never show up again. Can we go back to your story, please? Fine. So the bulletin went out October 9th. That was the day the plan to kill Stanley Kent began. Walling folded her arms across her chest and just stared at him. Bosch thought that maybe she was beginning to see where he was going with the story, and she didn't like it. It works best if you start from the end and go backwards, Bosch said. Alicia Kent gave you the name Moby. How could she have gotten that name? She overheard one of them calling the other one by that name. Bosch shook his head. No. She told you she overheard it, but if she was lying, how would she know the name to lie about it? Just coincidence that she gives the nickname of a guy who less than 6 months ago was confirmed as being in the country, in L.A. County, no less? I don't think so, Rachel. And neither do you. The odds of that probably can't be calculated. Okay, so you're saying that somebody in the Bureau, or another agency that received the FBI bulletin I wrote, gave her the name? Bosch nodded and pointed at her. Right. He gave her the name so she could come out with it while being questioned by the FBI's master interrogator. That name, along with the plan to dump the car in front of Ramin Samir's house, would act in concert to send this whole thing down the wrong road with the FBI and everybody else chasing after terrorists who had nothing to do with it. He? I'm getting to that now. You are right. Anybody who got a look at that bulletin would have been able to give her that name. My guess is that would be a lot of people. A lot of people just in L.A. alone. So how do we narrow it down to one? You tell me. Bosch opened the bottle and drank the rest of the water. He held the empty bottle in his hand as he continued. You narrow it down by continuing to go backwards. Where would Alicia Kent's life have intersected with one of those people in the agencies who knew about Moby? Walling frowned and shook her head. That could have been anywhere with those kinds of parameters. In line at the supermarket or when she was buying fertilizer for her roses, anywhere. Bosch now had her right where he wanted her to be. Then narrow the parameters, he said. Where would she have intersected with someone who knew about Moby, but also knew that her husband had access to the sort of radioactive materials Moby might be interested in? Now she shook her head in a dismissive way. Nowhere. It would take a monumental coincidence to... She stopped when it came to her. Enlightenment and shock as she fully understood where Bosch was going. My partner and I visited the Kents to warn them early last year. I guess what you're saying is that makes me a suspect. Bosch shook his head. I said he, remember? You didn't come here alone. Her eyes fired when she registered the implication. That's ridiculous. There's no way. I can't believe you would... She didn't finish as her mind snagged on something. Some memory that undermined her trust and loyalty to her partner. Bosch picked up on the tell and moved in closer. What? He asked. Nothing. What? Look, she insisted. Take my advice and tell no one this theory of yours. You're lucky you told me first, because this makes you sound like some kind of crackpot with a vendetta. You have no evidence, no motive, no incriminating statements, nothing. You just have this thing you've spun out of a yoga poster. There is no other explanation that fits with the facts, and I'm talking about the facts of the case, not the fact that the Bureau and Homeland Security and the rest of the federal government would love this to be a terrorism event so they can justify their existence and deflect criticism from other failings. Contrary to what you want to think, there is evidence and there are incriminating statements. If we put Alicia Kent on a lie detector, you'll find out that everything she told me, you, and the master interrogator downtown is a lie. The real master was Alicia Kent, as in master manipulator. Walling leaned forward and looked down at the floor. Thank you, Harry. That master interrogator you love deriding happens to have been me. Bosch's mouth dropped open for a moment before he spoke. Oh, well then, sorry. But it doesn't matter. The point is, she is a master liar. She lied about everything, and now that we know the story, it will be easy to smoke her out. Walling got up from her seat and walked over to the front picture window. The vertical blinds were closed, but she split them with a finger and stared out into the street. Bosch could see her working the story over, grinding it down. What about the witness? She asked without turning around. He heard the shooter yell, Allah! Are you saying he's part of this? Or are you saying they just happened to know he was there and yelled Allah as part of this master manipulation? Now Bosch sat down and gently tried to clear his throat. It was burning and making it difficult for him to talk. No, on that I think it's just a lesson in hearing what you want to hear. I plead guilty to not being much of a master interrogator myself. The kid told me that he heard the shooter yell it as he pulled the trigger. He said he wasn't sure, but that it sounded like Allah, and that, of course, worked with what I was thinking at the time. I heard what I wanted to hear. Walling came away from the window, sat back down, and folded her arms. Bosch finally sat down on a chair directly across from her. He continued. But how would the witness know it was the shooter and not the victim who yelled? He asked. He was more than 50 yards away. It was dark. How would he know that it wasn't Stanley Kent yelling out his last word before execution? The name of the woman he loved, because he was about to die not even knowing that she'd betrayed him. Alicia. Exactly. Alicia followed by a gunshot becomes Allah. Walling relaxed her arms and leaned forward. As body language went, it was a good sign. It told Bosch he was pushing through. You said the first set of snap ties before. What were you talking about? Bosch nodded and handed her the file containing the crime scene photos. He had saved the best for last. Look at the photos, he said. What do you see? She opened the file and started looking at the crime scene photos. They depicted the master bedroom in the Kent house from all angles. It's the master bedroom, she said. What am I missing? Exactly. What? It's what you don't see. There are no clothes in the shot. She told us they told her to sit on the bed and take off her clothes. What are we supposed to believe, that they let her put the clothes away before they hogtied her? They let her put them in the hamper? Look at the last shot. It's the email photo Stanley Kent got. Walling looked through the file until she found the printout of the email photo. She stared intently at it. He saw recognition break in her eyes. Now what do you see? The robe, she said excitedly. When we let her get dressed, she went to the closet to get her robe. There was no robe on that lounge chair. Bosch nodded, and they started trading pieces of the story back and forth. What does that tell us? He asked. That these considerate terrorists hung the robe up in the closet for her after taking the photo? Or that maybe Mrs. Kent was tied up twice, and the robe was moved in between? And look again at the picture. The clock on the bed table is unplugged. Why? I don't know, but maybe they didn't want to worry about having any sort of time stamp on the photo. Maybe the first photo wasn't even taken yesterday. Maybe it came from a dry run 2 days ago or even 2 weeks. Rachel nodded, and Bosch knew she was committed. She was a believer. She was tied up once for the photo and then once again for the rescue, she said. Exactly. And that left her free to help carry out the plan on the Overlook. She didn't kill her husband, but she was up there in the other car. And once Stanley was dead and the cesium was dumped and the car was ditched at Samir's, she and her partner came back home and she was tied up all over again. She wasn't passed out when we got there. That was an act and part of the plan. And her wetting the bed was a nice little touch to help sell it to us. The smell of urine also covered up the smell of grape juice. What do you mean? The purple bruises on her wrists and ankles. Now we know she wasn't tied up for hours, but she still had those bruises. There's an open bottle of grape juice in the fridge and paper towels soaked with it out in the trash can. She used grape juice to create the bruises. Oh, my God. I can't believe this. What? When I was in the room with her at TIU, that small space, I thought I smelled grape in the room. I thought somebody had been in there before us and had been drinking grape juice. I smelled it. There you go. There was no doubt now. Bosch had her. But then a shadow of concern and doubt moved across Walling's face like a summer cloud. What about motive? She asked. This is a federal agent we're talking about. To move on this, we need everything, even motive. There can be nothing left open to chance. Bosch had been ready for the question. You saw the motive. Alicia Kent is a beautiful woman. Jack Brenner wanted her, and Stanley Kent was in the way of that. Walling's eyes widened in shock. Bosch pressed on with his case. That's the motive, Rachel. Let me just finish. It goes like this. You and your partner show up here that day last year to give the Kents the warning about his occupation. Some kind of vibe is exchanged between Alicia and Jack. He gets interested. She gets interested. They meet on the sly for coffee or for drinks or whatever. One thing leads to another. An affair begins, and it lasts, and then it lasts to the point that it's time to start thinking about doing something. Leaving the husband. Or getting rid of him because there's insurance and half a company at stake. That's enough motive right there, Rachel. And that's what this case is about. It's not about cesium or terrorism or anything else. It's the basic equation. Sex plus money equals murder. That's all. She frowned and shook her head. You don't know what you're talking about. Jack Brenner is married and has 3 children. He's stable, boring, and not interested. He wasn't. Every man is interested. It doesn't matter if they're married or how many kids they have. She spoke quietly. Would you listen and let me finish now? You are wrong about Brenner. He never met Alicia Kent before today. He wasn't my partner when I came here last year, and I never told you he was. Bosch was jolted by the news. He'd assumed that her current partner had been her partner last year. He'd had Brenner's image locked and loaded in his mind as he had unfolded the story. At the start of the year, all partners in TIU were shuffled. It's the routine. It promotes a better team concept. I've been with Jack since January. Who was your partner last year, Rachel? She held his eyes for a long moment. It was Cliff Maxwell. Chapter 19. Harry Bosch almost laughed, but was too shocked to do anything but shake his head. Rachel Walling was telling him that Cliff Maxwell was Alicia Kent's partner in murder. I can't believe this, he finally said. About 4 hours ago, I had the killer handcuffed on the floor, right here. Rachel looked mortified by the realization that the murder of Stanley Kent was an inside job, and the theft of the cesium was nothing more than a well-played misdirection. You see the rest now? Bosch asked. You see how he would work it? Her husband's dead, and he starts coming around out of sympathy, and because he's on the case. They start dating, fall in love, and nobody ever raises an eyebrow about it. They're still out there looking for Moby and Al-Fayed. And what if we ever catch those guys? Walling said, taking up the story. They could deny being a part of this thing until Osama bin Laden dies in a cave of old age. But who would believe them or care? There's nothing more ingenious than framing terrorists with a crime they didn't commit. They can never defend themselves. Bosch nodded. A perfect crime, he said. The only reason it blew up was because Digoberto Gonzalez checked that dumpster. Without him, we'd still be chasing Moby and Al-Fayed, probably thinking that they had used Samir's place as a safe house. So what do we do now, Bosch? Bosch shrugged, but then answered anyway. I say we set up a classic rat trap. Put them both in rooms, ring the bell, and say the first one who talks gets the deal. I'd bet on Alicia. She'll break and give him up, probably blame him for everything, say she was acting under his influence and control. Something tells me you're right, and the truth is I don't think Maxwell was smart enough to pull this off. I worked with... Her cell phone started buzzing. She took it out of her pocket and looked at the screen. It's Jack. Find out where Maxwell is. She answered the call and first answered a few questions about Bosch's status, telling Brenner that he was okay but was losing his voice because his throat hurt. Bosch got up for another bottle of water but listened from the kitchen. Walling casually steered the call toward Maxwell. Hey, where's Cliff, by the way? I wanted to talk to him about that thing with Bosch in the hallway. I didn't like what he... She stopped and listened to the answer, and Bosch saw her eyes immediately become alert. Something was wrong. When was that? She asked. She listened again and stood up. Listen, Jack, I've got to go. I think Bosch is about to be discharged. I'll check in as soon as I'm clear here. She closed the phone and looked at Bosch. I can't stand lying to him. He won't forget it. What did he say? He said there were too many agents at the recovery scene. Just about everybody came out from downtown, and they were standing around waiting on the radiation team. So Maxwell volunteered to go pick up the witness at the Mark Twain. Nobody had gotten around to it because I'd pulled off the original pickup team.
He went alone?
That's what Jack said.
How long ago?
A half hour.
He's going to kill him.
Bosch started moving quickly toward the door. Chapter 20. Bosch drove this time. On the way toward Hollywood, he told Walling that Jesse Mitford had no phone in his room. The Mark Twain wasn't much when it came to full service. Instead, Bosch called the watch commander at Hollywood Division and asked him to send a patrol car to the hotel to check on the witness. He then called information and was connected to the front desk at the Mark Twain. Alvin, this is Detective Bosch. From this morning?
Yeah, what's up with you, Detective?
Has anyone come in asking for Stephen King?
Nope.
In the last 20 minutes, have you buzzed in anybody who looked like a cop or who wasn't a tenant there?
No, Detective, what's going on?
Listen, I need you to go up to that room and tell Stephen King to get out of there and then to call me on my cell.
I got nobody to watch the desk, Detective.
It's an emergency, Alvin. I need to get him out of there. It will take you less than 5 minutes. Here, write this down. My number is 323-244-5631. You got it?
I got it.
Okay, go. And if anybody but me comes in there looking for him, say he checked out, took a refund and left. Go, Alvin, and thanks. Bosch closed the phone and looked over at Rachel. His face showed his lack of confidence in the desk man. I think the guy's a tweaker. Bosch increased his speed and tried to concentrate on driving. They had just turned south on Cahuenga off Barham. He was thinking that, depending on traffic in Hollywood, they could get to the Mark Twain in another 5 minutes. This conclusion made him shake his head. With a half-hour lead, Maxwell should already be at the Mark Twain. He wondered if he had slipped in the back way and already gotten to Mitford. "Maxwell may have already gone in through the back," he told Walling. "I'm going to come in from the alley."
"You know," Walling said, "maybe he's not going to hurt him. He'll pick him up and talk to him, judge for himself if he saw enough at the Overlook that he'd be a threat."
Boss shook his head. "No way. Maxwell's got to know that once the cesium was found, his plan was going down the toilet. He's got to take action against all threats. First the witness, then Alicia Kent."
"Alicia Kent? You think he'd make a move against her? This whole thing is because of her."
"Doesn't matter now. Survival instincts take over now, and she's a threat. It goes with the territory. You cross the big line to be with her. You cross it again to save your..."
Bosch stopped talking as a sudden realization thudded in his chest. He cursed out loud and pinned the accelerator as they came out of the Cahuenga Pass. He cut across three lanes of Highland Avenue in front of the Hollywood Bowl and made a screeching U-turn in front of oncoming traffic. He punched it, and the car fishtailed wildly as he headed toward the southbound entrance to the Hollywood Freeway. Rachel grabbed the dashboard and a door handle to hold on.
"Harry, what are you doing? This is the wrong way!"
He flicked on the siren and the blue lights that flashed in the front grille and back window of the car. He yelled his response to Walling.
"Mitford is a misdirection. This is the right way. Who is the greater threat to Maxwell? Alicia? You bet, and now's the best shot he has of getting her out of tactical. Everybody's up in that alley with the cesium."
The freeway was moving pretty well, and the siren helped open it up further. Bosch figured Maxwell could have already gotten to downtown, depending on what kind of traffic he encountered. Rachel opened her phone and started punching in numbers. She tried number after number, but no one was answering.
"I can't get anybody," she yelled.
"Where's T.I.U.?"
Walling didn't hesitate.
"On Broadway. You know where the $1 Million Theater is? Same building. Entrance on 3rd.
Bosch flicked off the siren and opened his phone. He called his partner, and Ferris answered right away.
"Ignacio, where are you?"
"Just got back to the office. Forensics worked the car for..."
"Listen to me. Drop what you're doing and meet me at the 3rd Street entrance to the $1 Million Theater building. You know where that is?"
"What's going on?"
"Do you know where the $1 Million Theater is?"
"Yeah, I know where it is."
"Meet me there at the 3rd Street entrance. I'll explain when I get there."
He closed the phone and hit the siren again. Chapter 21. The next 10 minutes took 10 hours. Bosch moved in and out of traffic and finally reached the Broadway exit downtown. He killed the siren as he made the turn and headed down the hill toward their destination. They were 3 blocks away. The $1 Million Theater was built in a time when the movie business showed itself off in magnificent theater palaces that lined Broadway downtown. But it had been decades since a first-run film had been projected on a screen there. Its ornate facade had been covered by a lighted marquee that for a time announced religious revivals instead of movies. Now the theater waited unused for renovation and redemption, while above it a once grand office building was 12 stories of mid-grade office space and residential lofts.
"Good place for a secret unit to have a secret office," Bosch said as the building came into sight. "Nobody would have guessed."
Walling didn't respond. She was trying to make another call. She then slapped the phone closed in frustration.
"I can't even get our secretary. She always takes lunch after 1, so there will be somebody in the office when the agents go to lunch earlier.
Where exactly is the squad, and where would Alicia Kent be in there?"
"We have the whole 7th floor. There's a lounge room with a couch and a TV. They put her in there so she could watch TV."
"How many in the squad?"
8 agents, the secretary and an office manager. The office manager just went out on maternity leave, and the secretary must be at lunch.
"I hope."
"But they wouldn't have left Alicia Kent alone. It's against policy. Somebody had to have stayed there with her."
Bosch turned right on 3rd and immediately pulled to the curb. Ignacio Ferris was already there, leaning casually against his Volvo station wagon. In front of it was another parked car, a federal cruiser. Bosch and Walling got out. Bosch approached Ferris,
and Walling went to look inside the Fed car.
"Have you seen Maxwell?" Bosch asked.
"Who?"
"Agent Maxwell, the guy we put on the floor at the Kent house this morning."
"No, I haven't seen anybody."
"What?"
"It's his car," Walling said as she joined them.
"Ignacio, this is Agent Walling.
Call me Iggy."
"Rachel."
They shook hands.
"Okay, then he's got to be up there," Bosch said.
"How many stairwells?"
3, Walling said, "but he'll use the one that comes out by his car."
She pointed to a pair of double steel doors near the corner of the building. Bosch headed over that way to see if they were locked. Ferris and Walling followed.
"What is going on?" Ferris asked.
"Maxwell is our shooter," Bosch said. "He is up."
"What?"
Bosch checked the exit doors. There was no outside handle or knob. He turned to Ferris. "Look, there's not a lot of time. Trust me. Maxwell is our guy, and he's in this building to take out Alicia Kent.
What is she doing here?"
"The FBI has a location here. She's here. No more questions, okay? Just listen. Agent Walling and I are going up in the elevator. I want you out here by this door. If Maxwell comes out, you take him down. You understand? You take him down."
"Got it."
"Good. Call for backup. We're going up." Bosch reached over and tapped Ferris on the cheek. "And stay frosty." They left Ferris there and headed through the building's main entrance. There was no lobby to speak of, just an elevator. It opened at the push of the button, and Walling used a key card to engage the 7 button. They started going up.
"Something tells me you're never going to call him Iggy," Walling said.
Bosch ignored the comment, but thought of something to ask. "Does this thing have a bell or a tone that sounds when it reaches the floor?"
"I can't remember. I think it does. Yes, definitely."
"Great. We'll be sitting ducks." Bosch pulled his Kimber out of its holster and chambered around. Walling did the same with her weapon. Bosch pushed Walling to one side of the elevator while he took the other. He raised his gun. The elevator finally reached 7, and there was a soft bell tone from outside. The door began to slide open, exposing Bosch first. No one was there. Rachel pointed to the left, signaling that the offices were to the left after they exited the elevator. Bosch lowered himself into a combat crouch and stepped out, his gun up and ready. Again, no one was there. He started moving to his left. Rachel came out and moved with him on his right flank. They came to a loft-style office with 2 rows of cubicles, the squad room, and 3 private rooms that had been built freestanding in the open floor plan. There were large racks of electronic equipment between the cubicles, and every desk had 2 computer screens on it. It looked like the whole place could be packed up and moved at a moment's notice. Bosch stepped farther in, and through the window in one of the private offices, he saw a man sitting in a chair, his head back and eyes open. He looked like he was wearing a red bib. But Bosch knew it was blood. The man had been shot in the chest. He pointed, and Rachel saw the dead man. She reacted with a quick intake of breath and a low-volume sigh. The door to the office was ajar. They moved toward it, and Bosch pushed it open while Walling covered them from behind. Bosch stepped in and saw Alicia Kent sitting on the floor, her back to the wall. He crouched beside her. Her eyes were open, but dead. A gun was on the floor between her feet, and the wall behind her was spattered with blood and brain matter. Bosch turned and surveyed the room. He understood the play. It was set up so it would look like Alicia Kent had grabbed the agent's gun from his holster, shot him, and then sat down on the floor and took her own life. No note or explanation, but it was the best Maxwell could come up with in the short amount of time and opportunity that he had. Bosch turned to Walling. She had let her guard down and was just standing there looking at the dead agent. "Rachel," he said. "He's gotta still be here." He stood and moved toward the door so he could search the squad room. As he glanced through the window,
he saw movement behind the electronics racks. He stopped, raised his weapon, and tracked someone moving behind one of the racks toward a door with an exit sign on it. In a moment, he saw Maxwell break free of the cover and dash toward the door.
"Maxwell!" Bosch yelled. "Stop!"
Maxwell spun and raised a weapon. At the same moment that his back hit the exit door, he started firing. The window shattered, and glass sprayed across Bosch. He returned fire and put 6 shots into the opening of the exit door, but Maxwell was gone.
"Rachel," he called without taking his eyes off the door, "okay?"
"I'm fine."
Her voice came from below him. He knew she had hit the floor when the shooting had started. "Which exit is that door?" Rachel stood up. Bosch moved toward the door, glancing at her, and saw glass all over her clothes and that she had been cut on the cheek. "Those stairs go down to his car." Bosch ran from the room toward the exit door. He opened his phone as he went and pushed the speed dial for his partner. The call was answered on half a ring. Bosch was already in the stairwell. "He's coming down." Bosch dropped the phone and started down the stairs. He could hear Maxwell running on the steel steps below and instinctively knew that he was too far ahead. Chapter 22. Bosch covered 3 more landings, taking 3 steps at a time. He could now hear Walling coming down behind him. He then heard the booming sound from below as Maxwell hit the exit door at the bottom. There were immediate shouts, and then there were shots. They came so close together it was impossible to determine which had come first or how many shots had been fired. 10 seconds later, Bosch hit the exit door. He came out onto the sidewalk and saw Ferris leaning against the back bumper of Maxwell's Fed car. He was holding his weapon with one hand and his elbow with the other. A red rose of blood was blooming on his shoulder. Traffic had stopped in both directions on 3rd, and pedestrians were running down the sidewalks to safety.
"I hit him twice," Ferris yelled. "He went that way."
He nodded in the direction of the 3rd Street tunnel under Bunker Hill. Bosch stepped closer to his partner and saw the wound in the ball of his shoulder. It didn't look too bad.
"Did you call for backup?" Bosch asked.
"On the way."
Ferris grimaced as he adjusted his hold on his injured arm.
"You did real good, Iggy. Hang in there while I go get this guy."
Ferris nodded. Bosch turned and saw Rachel come through the door, a smear of blood on her face.
"This way," he said. "He's hit."
They started down 3rd in a spread formation. After a few steps, Bosch picked up the trail. Maxwell was obviously hurt badly and was losing a lot of blood. It would make him easy to track. But when they got to the corner of 3rd and Grand, they lost the trail. There was no blood on the pavement. Bosch looked into the long 3rd Street tunnel and saw no one moving in the traffic on foot. He looked up and down Hill Street and saw nothing until his attention was drawn to a commotion of people running out of the Grand Central Market.
"This way," he said.
They moved quickly toward the huge market. Bosch picked up the blood trail again just outside and started in. The market was a 2-story-high conglomeration of food booths and retail and produce concessions. There was a strong smell of grease and coffee in the air that had to infect every floor of the building above the market. The place was crowded and noisy, and that made it difficult for Bosch to follow the blood and track Maxwell. Then suddenly there were shouts from directly ahead, and 2 quick shots were fired into the air. It caused an immediate human stampede. Dozens of screaming shoppers and workers flooded into the aisle where Bosch and Walling stood and started running toward them. Bosch realized they were going to be run over and trampled. In one motion, he moved to his right, grabbed Walling around the waist, and pulled her behind one of the wide concrete support pillars. The crowd moved by, and then Bosch looked around the pillar. The market was now empty. There was no sign of Maxwell. But then Bosch picked up movement in one of the cold cases that fronted a butcher shop at the end of the aisle. He looked again closely and realized that the movement came from behind the case. Looking through the front and back glass panels and over the display of cuts of beef and pork, Bosch could see Maxwell's face. He was on the ground, leaning his back against a refrigerator in the rear of the butcher shop.
"He's up ahead in the butcher shop,"
he whispered to Walling.
"You go to the right and down that aisle. You'll be able to come up on his right. What about you? I'll go straight on and get his attention. Or we could wait for backup." "I'm not waiting."
"I didn't think so."
"Ready?" "No, switch. I go head on and get his attention, and you come around the side."
Bosch knew it was the better plan because she knew Maxwell and Maxwell knew her, but it also meant she would face the most danger.
"You sure?" he asked.
"Yes, it's right."
Bosch looked around the pillar one more time and saw that Maxwell had not moved. His face looked red and sweaty. Bosch looked back at Walling. "He's still there."
"Good. Let's do it."
They separated and started moving. Bosch quickly moved down an aisle of concessions, one over from the aisle that ended at the butcher shop. When he came to the end, he was at a Mexican coffee shop with high walls. He was able to protect himself and look around the corner at the butcher shop. This gave him a side view behind the counter. He saw Maxwell 20 feet away. He was slouched against the refrigerator door, still holding his weapon in two hands. His shirt was completely soaked in blood. Bosch leaned back into cover, gathered himself, and got ready to step out and approach Maxwell. But then he heard Walling's voice.
"Cliff, it's me, Rachel. Let me get you some help."
Bosch looked around the corner. Walling was standing out in the open 5 feet in front of the deli counter, her gun down at her side.
"There is no help," Maxwell said. "It's too late for me."
Bosch recognized that if Maxwell wanted to take a shot at her, the bullet would have to go through both the front and back glass panels of the deli case. With the front plate set at an angle, it would take a miracle bullet to get to her. But miracles did happen. Bosch raised his weapon, braced it against the wall, and was ready to shoot if he needed to.
"Come on, Cliff," Walling said. "Give it up. Don't end it like this."
"No other way."
Maxwell's body was suddenly racked by a deep, wet coughing. Blood came to his lips.
"Jesus, that guy really got me,"
he said before coughing again.
"Cliff," Walling pleaded, "let me come in there. I want to help."
"No, you come in, and I'm going to..."
His words were lost when he opened fire on the deli case, sweeping his gun and shooting out the glass doors all the way down. Rachel ducked down and Bosch stepped out and straightened his arms in a two-handed grip. He held himself from shooting, but keyed on the barrel of Maxwell's weapon. If the muzzle zeroed in on Walling, he was going to shoot Maxwell in the head. Maxwell lowered his weapon to his lap and started to laugh, blood rolling down from both corners of his mouth and creating a freak clown look.
I think I just killed a porterhouse.
He laughed again, but it made him start to cough once more, and that looked painful. When it subsided, he spoke again.
"I just want to say that it was her. She wanted him dead. I just wanted her. That's all. But she wouldn't have it any other way. And I did what she wanted. For that, I am damned."
Bosch took a step closer. He didn't think that Maxwell had noticed him yet. He took one more step, and then Maxwell spoke again.
"I'm sorry,"
he said.
"Rachel, tell him I'm sorry."
"Cliff," Walling said, "you can tell them that yourself."
As Bosch watched, Maxwell brought his gun up and put the muzzle under his chin. Without hesitation, he pulled the trigger. The impact snapped his head back and sent a splatter of blood up the refrigerator door. The gun dropped onto the concrete floor between his outstretched legs. In his suicide, Maxwell had adopted the same position as his lover,
the woman he had just killed. Walling came around the case and stood next to Bosch, and together they looked down at the dead agent. She said nothing. Bosch checked his watch. It was almost one. He had ridden the case from beginning to end in little more than 12 hours. The tally was 5 dead, 1 wounded, and 1 dying of radiation exposure. And then there was himself. Bosch wondered if he was going to be part of the tally by the time all was said and done. His throat was now blazing, and there was a feeling of heaviness in his chest. He looked at Rachel and saw blood running down her cheek again. She would need stitches to close the wound. "You know what?" he said. "I'll take you to the hospital if you take me." She looked at him and smiled sort of sadly. "Throw in Iggy and you've got yourself a deal." Bosch left her there with Maxwell and walked back to the $1 million theater building to check on his partner. While he was on his way, backup units were pulling in everywhere and crowds were forming. Bosch decided he would leave it to the patrol officers to take charge of the crime scenes. Ferras was sitting in the open door of his car, waiting for the paramedics. He was holding his arm at an awkward angle and was clearly in pain. The blood had spread on his shirt. "You want some water?" Bosch asked. "I've got a bottle in my trunk." "No, I'll just wait. I wish they'd get here." The signature siren of a fire rescue paramedic truck could be heard in the distance, getting closer. "What happened, Harry?" Bosch leaned against the side of the car and told him that Maxwell had just killed himself as they had closed in on him. "Hell of a way to go, I guess," Ferris said. "Cornered like that." Bosch nodded, but kept silent. As they waited, his thoughts carried him down the streets and up the hills to the overlook, where the last thing Stanley Kent ever saw was the city spread before him in beautiful, shimmering lights. Maybe to Stanley, it looked like heaven was waiting for him at the end. But Bosch thought that it didn't really matter if you died cornered in a butcher shop or on an overlook glimpsing the lights of heaven. You were gone, and the finale wasn't the part that mattered. "We are all circling the drain," he thought. "Some are closer to the black hole than others. Some will see it coming, and some will have no clue when the undertow of the whirlpool grabs them and pulls them down into darkness forever. The important thing is to fight it," Bosch told himself. "Always keep kicking. Always keep fighting the undertow." The rescue unit turned the corner at Broadway, working its way around several stopped cars before finally braking at the mouth of the alley and killing the siren. Bosch helped his partner up and out of the car, and they walked to the paramedics. Acknowledgements. This is a work of fiction. In making it up, the author relied upon the help of several experts in the fields the story moved across. Most notably, the author wishes to thank Drs. Larry Gandel and Ignacio Ferres for patiently responding to every question put to them in regard to the practice of oncology, medical physics, and the use and handling of cesium. In the field of law enforcement, the author would be lost in the woods without the help of Rick Jackson, David Lamkin, Tim Marcia, Greg Couch, and a few others who prefer anonymity. Any mistakes or exaggerations in these areas contained in The Overlook are purely the fault of the author. The author also wishes to acknowledge the editorial help and generosity of Asya Muchnik, Michael Peach, Bill Massey, and Jane Wood, as well as Terrell Lee Lankford, Pamela Marshall, Carolyn Chris, Shannon Byrne, Jane Davis, and Linda Connolly.
This has been an Hachette Audio production of The Overlook, written by Michael Connolly and read by Len Carreyrou, featuring original music composed and performed by Frank Morgan, directed by John McElroy, produced by Linda Korn, Digital editing and mastering by Dion Audio. The Overlook is also available in print from Little Brown & Company, a division of Hachette Book Group USA. Text copyright 2006 by Hieronymus Inc. Audio production copyright and published 2007 by Hachette Audio. All rights reserved. Except as permitted under the U.S. Copyright Act of 1976, no part of this publication may be reproduced, distributed, or transmitted in any form or by any means, or stored in a database or retrieval system without the prior written permission of the publisher. This audiobook is a work of fiction. Names, characters, places, and incidents are either the product of the author's imagination or are used fictitiously, and any resemblance to actual persons, living or dead, events or locales, is entirely coincidental. ¶¶